Good morning. This is Brian Wickert on WDRT with the program Conversations. And today we're very fortunate to have our county sheriff with us, Roy Torgerson. Good morning, Roy.
Well, good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Good. So I'm really excited, I would have to say, to talk about all the things that the county sheriff's office does, because most of the time people have to do with a sheriff, it's almost an accident, a robbery, or some crime. But you guys are real people, and I just want to get the people to know what you guys do other than just what we see on the 10 o'clock news.
Well, thank you. We are real people. We have real families, and we have real emotions, and we experience a lot of what everyone else in this community experiences, and we're so glad to have this opportunity to talk to the people.
Good. So let's start, Roy, with you. Give us a little background, you know, where you grew up and how you kind of got started in law enforcement.
Well, I grew up on a farm just a mile and a half east of Viroqua here. I've been a Viroqua resident my entire life.
Was it a tobacco or dairy farm?
Dairy farm, and we had tobacco. In fact, that was my birthday falls right around Labor Day. So often off the school bus and into the tobacco field to pile the plants.
Good. All right, so you grew up on a farm. Go ahead.
I had a couple of jobs in high school, and I started at the sheriff's office when I was 20 years old in 1992, mm-hmm. so that'll date me a little bit.
Good.
Yes. I started at the our old building, which is now referred to as the Banta Building.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired by Sheriff Jeff Banta and Under Sheriff Jerry Fredrickson, and I was hired as a communications as a dispatcher. Radio operator was a common term, mm-hmm. at that time, and I worked mainly third shift. We
yep.
had three shifts then, and now we have only two shifts with 12 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But I would often work the late night shift, and when I first started, they had just hired a third shift jailer, and we worked 6 days on, 3 days off. So if it happened to be the 3 days the jailer was off, then I would have to also take care of the jail at night, which a lot of the folks before mm-hmm. me did as well, so that was not all that uncommon, and now we're more separated.
Mm-hmm.
But those were good opportunities for me to not only, you know, interact with the public on the telephone and getting back into the jail setting, you just really learn to treat people the way you'd want to be treated yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Good. So what'd you do after you were a dispatcher?
Well, I dispatched for 17 and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
I attended the Law Enforcement Academy in the middle of that in 2001 and began working some patrol shifts alongside the dispatch responsibilities. And then in the fall of 2009, I went to the patrol section.
All right. So how long were you a patrol officer, and what was that like? What were some of the experiences there?
Oh, a lot of experiences. I am so thankful that I started on the inside. I'm so thankful I had that those opportunities in dispatch, in the jail, because I used all of that experience when I would answer calls for service. Mm-hmm. And there again, it's not what you say, it is how you say it. You need to have that very active a form of listening, and listen to listen, not mm-hmm. necessarily listen to respond. These folks, as you said earlier, Brian, they may not have ever called law enforcement,
right, the public.
Until they have a problem. So we need to keep that in mind, and their problem is front and center to them. It may be a problem that we've handled on many different occasions. They've never experienced it, so you have to just slow down and show that compassion, mainly empathy, mm-hmm. Depending on the type of situation, but you really have to listen to their concerns. Brian, you and I have had the conversation about communication, and when you called me for this interview, we talked about the breakdown of communication, and that's probably the root of many, many disagreements is poor communication.
Yeah, I always say that 95% of conflict is just misunderstanding. If you take the time and say, we're really on the same page. But if you have a conflict, 95% of the time it's just misunderstanding.
And I'm learning not to jump ahead, but as sheriff, that's 90% of my job is to actively listen to any concerns that might hit my desk.
Yeah. So let's go back. So you were the dispatch, then you're on patrol, and then when did you get back into administration, and then when did you decide to run for sheriff?
Okay. So the fall of 2009, I temporarily went out onto patrol just fill a position that was empty, and then I permanently went to patrol in 2010, and I worked not quite a year of nights, and I had already worked 17 and a half years of night PMs or the late night or a combination thereof. So in 2010, I went to the day shift, and it was an advancement to me. Working those nights, they can get tough on you. I don't think our bodies were quite meant for that.
No. So then, how long were you a patrolman?
So I was on patrol from 2010 until the time I took over and was sworn in as sheriff on January 3rd of this year.
Good. So who's your under-sheriff now?
Right now, so can we talk a little bit about the under-sheriff?
Yep.
So some counties have a chief deputy, which is a position created by the county, and often your chief deputy is the undersheriff, but statute 59 gives me a time limit or any sheriff a time limit to appoint an undersheriff. So right now my chief deputy is Nathan Campbell, and my undersheriff is Jason Kroom.
So Nathan what was his position with John Spears?
Chief deputy, and that was
so he's still your chief deputy?
Correct.
So that's consistency there. And then what's the other guy, Jason what?
Jason Kroom. He's currently a lieutenant, and, of course, the undersheriff would only need to act if I'm unable to fulfill my duties.
Okay, so Nathan helps with all the administration stuff in the building, and Jason, if you fall down, he's like the vice president that steps in and takes over.
That would be a good comparison
right.
There, yes.
Good. So Nathan, I imagine, is pretty essential for you because he's been there for several years to help things running smoothly, right?
The idea of the chief deputy versus an undersheriff, although you still statutorily have to have an undersheriff, but it gives you that continuity if maybe you have quite an age difference in your sheriff versus your chief deputy, and it allows for a smoother transition.
Good. All right, so you were working late night hours, and at one point you got married late in life, right?
So tell us
a little bit about that, because you told me all the nights you worked. I says, that's not very good for dating.
So I was single for many, many years, and I threw myself at my work, and I love my work. I love going into the sheriff's office, love putting my uniform on, and I met a young lady by the name of Sandra, mm-hmm. and she was living toward Madison when I met her in 2013, mm-hmm. and we were eventually married, and we take care of her grandchildren. They were 4 and 5 at the time, and now they're 14 and 15.
And one of them has autism, right?
Yes.
So high needs.
Yep, high needs. Well, I don't know about high needs. Maybe he takes care of us more than...
well, they sort of teach us a lot.
Yes. It was I took my little boy to an appointment, and with autism, you're in tune to a schedule, a routine, and he did recite the... you know, taking him to this appointment during school time, he recited the Pledge of Allegiance in the vehicle because that was the time that that needed to occur.
At the school.
At the school.
So that rhythm for them is so important.
Yes.
God, that's great that you did that. All right, so let's go back to the sheriff's office a little bit. We got the undersheriff and chief deputy, right? We described those.
Correct.
So what are some of the other programs that you have at this at the sheriff's office?
We have so many programs. I look at the size of our office and compared to other agencies, and we do a lot with a little. We have so many different programs.
Let me go back. Let's talk about the budget then first.
Sure.
Because you said you do so much with so little. I don't think people understand exactly where your money comes from or how much you come from. So I know the county budget a few years ago was about $19 million. What's your budget for the sheriff's office? The
sheriff's office budget is just a little bit over $5.3 million.
All right. And has that changed much in the last few years? Has it gone up or down?
It has not changed over the years. We've had to find ways to make it work, and you don't want that to affect services in mm-hmm. the community. You do your very best to keep those services going.
So of your budget, do you have an idea of how it breaks down to how much is it the administration running the jail, how much are for patrol officers, and how much are for community outreach type of stuff? Is that, would that be a good example of how it's broken up?
Yes. Although I wouldn't have the exact numbers, mm-hmm. about 85% of the budget is wages and benefits. Mm-hmm. So you take that right off of the top, and we got some great people that work so hard every day. I would say if you split patrol, dispatch, investigations, I think it's pretty even split with the mm-hmm. rest of those funds that I'm left to work with.
So how many people in the sheriff's office?
Counting our maintenance, 911 mm-hmm. dispatchers, correctional officers, deputy sheriffs, investigators, sheriff, chief deputy, you're looking at 52 employees.
52, that's a good number. So how would that break out as far as the number of jailers, number of patrol people, administration? How would the numbers break out? Would it be like 30 patrol officers and, you know, less in the other place? But how many in each area?
So we have 26 sworn deputy sheriffs.
Okay, out of 52, so half of them.
Right, yep, and that's counting the sheriff and the chief deputy investigators. Mm-hmm. When I started, most of the employees were all sworn deputy sheriffs. When we constructed the new facility that we occupied in 2005, at that time, we hired 13 correctional staff, and the decision was made to hire them as civilian employees.
Right. So the correctional staff, when that building was put up, is because you were able to get a lot of state and other county inmates to house them, correct?
Correct. We housed Monroe County. They were building a new jail, and we housed their inmates for quite some time. And that essentially has helped pay for that building.
Mm-hmm.
We housed several state prison inmates up until a little over a year ago when they were taken out, and that was a hard hit. We had hired some extra staff to cover that type of a population, and it just happened. We had some movement when the state inmates were removed from the facility. We were able to absorb some into the patrol division, so we didn't have to face laying anyone off.
So people quit, retired, moved positions, left the agency or left the office, and you were able to keep everybody that wanted to stay.
That's correct. It came down to timing there.
Mm-hmm. So how many outside inmates did you have at that time that brought in income for the county?
We were, at one point, our population were upwards of 90, and some of the contracts, I think, were somewhere between 40 and 50 beds. But we were bringing in $900,000 annually in revenue.
In service. How many Vernon County inmates do you usually have housed there currently?
Currently, I would say maybe 15 right now.
All right. And then you've got some, still have some state contracts?
Yes, we do house for the Department of Corrections when someone is... probation is part of their sentence. If they make a mistake while on probation, their agent has the authority to have them held for a certain amount of time, and then they're entitled to a hearing. So some of them are short stays. And sometimes the probation is actually revoked and it reverts back to their original sentence. So some of those folks might be awaiting prison, and they may be sitting for quite some time. And
what's quite some time?
I've seen them upwards of a year waiting to return to prison.
Okay. So average stay, is that a good question? Is that too many moving factors to have an average stay?
That's a tough one. You could have, you cannot sentence anyone on one particular occurrence to more than a year in the county jail. So over that, you'd be sent to a state prison.
So up to a year, you can hold somebody in a county jail?
Yes. That doesn't mean that they might be facing some other time, and that's consecutive. So someone could be in the county jail longer than a year, but no more than a year on one particular sentence.
So he might have two sentences, 18 or 6 months and 14 or 6 months and 8 months, but they do them consecutively. So once the six is up, he starts over again. So he's still under the 1 year thing, but he actually was there for 14 months.
Absolutely. So you will see that being more than a year, but not not more than 12 months on one sentence.
Mm-hmm. All right. So with the jail, I've heard of something called Huber.
Yes.
Can you tell me what that might be and how that works with you guys?
So the Huber Law was enacted where someone is sentenced to county jail and they're allowed work release, and that's what the Huber Law is. And there's a lot of moving parts to that, and that's a big... it's a big part of the sheriff's responsibility is doing the paperwork for the Huber Law, but that's what we want. We want them contributing back to society again. So we supervise their every move when they're on work release. They sit in 1 day a week, but there's a lot of different
jobs.
Now,
when you say sit in a week, means they can't leave the jail for that day?
For that day, correct. And it doesn't have to be a Sunday, or it could be any day of the week. But they sit in depending on their employment. But even if they're, if they come in and say, "Well, I work 7 days a week," you sit in 1 day a week, and that's part of the Huber Law.
So if one of the Huber Laws, he's he or she is working and they're coming back to jail, but let's say they've got a child and they've got a school play while they're out at work, and if they were working regularly, his employer would give them time off to go to see this child's play at school. Is that type of stuff possible?
There are very, very few extracurricular activities that would ever be approved. It'd be very, very limited. They're under a strict schedule, and when they're out working, we're going to do spot checks and make sure they're where they need to be. If they want to change locations for whatever reason, they need to call the jail and let the correctional staff know. So if we would happen to receive a call from one of the officers or someone on the street saying, hey, so-and-so, they're supposed to be in jail, and we could say, no, we did approve them walking to the auto parts store to, pick up parts for a vehicle that they're approved to work on.
Good. All right, just take a break here. This is Brian Wickert on WDRT with the program Conversations, and today we're speaking with Roy Torgerson, the Vernon County Sheriff, and we're talking about all the different things that the sheriff office does. So back to the office versus a department. That's been a big topic for me, of the difference between a sheriff's office versus a sheriff's or police department. Could you tell us a little bit about what the uniqueness and the importance of a sheriff's office is?
Well, the office is just that. It's an office. It's a constitutionally, it's a constitutional office. It's not another department of county government. And it's important that we make that distinction. You don't hear anyone say district attorney's department, do you?
No.
It's district attorney's office.
He was elected.
He was elected by the people. Just a couple of days ago, I posted a photo on our Facebook page of a young lady in a wheelchair type shopping cart, and I just put on there that I was meeting with one of my 30,000 bosses, and that got a lot of attention because that's who I report to. I report to you.
So, as the sheriff's office, I always say that you're the highest law enforcement authority in our county, and you don't answer to the governor, you don't answer to the National Guard, you answer to the people, right?
One of the most, going through this election was just one of the most humbling things I've ever experienced. You know, what a way to keep you grounded, to realize it makes you feel good about our system and how it's supposed to work. And you know, answering directly to the people, I think it's so important. And there again, very, very humbling to have gone through that process, and I respect it so much.
Good. One thing, this is on a side, if we're going out of downtown Viroqua up toward Quick Trip and then where you turn to go to the sheriff's office.
Yes.
There's a green highway sign. You know what it says on there?
Does it still say department? Well, I need to get to work on that.
Yeah, I always think we need to be precise because the sheriff office, it goes back, you know, hundreds of years to Old English law when the king's royalty would abuse the people in the shire. Mm-hmm. So they elected somebody to be their go-between between the people and the royalty, and that was the sheriff. And that beginning is where we came today, is your job is to protect us from federal government, state government, any of those type of overreaches. Mm-hmm. And I know right now we wonder about all the overreach on government. Do you have any thoughts or experiences of where you've been able to stand up and say, no, this is our area, not yours?
It's something that you watch every day. When I find out maybe a federal agency's coming to town, I want to know about that. Why are they here? What are they doing? And we may end up actually assisting them, but it's something you're always watching because there is that potential out there every day. And lot of our partners we work very well with, but I know that I answer to the people, and you know, there is some overreach out there, and that's where I think we stand between that.
Now, federal agencies, I'm talking like FBI, tobacco, guns, and et cetera. What would be some other federal agencies that you interact with?
We interact with the FBI from time to time. They have an agent in La Crosse. Certainly not an everyday basis, but now and then we do interact with them. We have prosecuted some cases through the United States Attorney, through the federal system. Not too many of them, but you might have a real large multi-jurisdictional drug case where it makes more sense to prosecute that through the federal courts. But I think we need to have that control here locally whenever possible.
Right. So speaking about law enforcement cases, different things like that, give us an overview of what kind of cases you do, how much time they take, so kind of categorize different types of cases, and then we'll go back and talk about each one and how much time it takes for you. So what would be the categories of cases you deal with?
So we investigate everything. We investigate burglaries, thefts, you name it. We do enforce some traffic laws, although that's not our primary concern. We want to keep everyone safe and do our part. So there is some traffic enforcement. Seeing a few more cases of impaired drivers, and we talked earlier, Brian, about working the night shift, and that's, you expected to see that more at night, and we're starting to see a little bit of that you know, throughout the day. Mm-hmm. You need to have officers highly trained to detect that type of impairment. So our officers are out doing that. But, you know, Brian, we try to be, you're talking about cases, we try to be as proactive as we can and be on a good offensive. And, you know, I know we'll talk about programs, but we do a lot of school walkthroughs. That'll be some of our programs that we talk about. So we're trying to make a positive, an opportunity to positively interact with the kids and not just show up when there's a problem.
Right, right. What kind of programs at the school and who does that for you?
So when I was appointed community policing officer by Sheriff Spears in 2016, that was...
You did it then.
I did it. And he was very successful in that role, and I followed his lead. I learned from Sheriff Spears on, mm-hmm. on how to be an effective community policing officer, and a lot of that surrounds what we're doing today, is being open with the public and being able to be on a first-name basis with as many of your friends and many of your neighbors that you see.
Yeah. John was successful at that, and to attest to that, his boys and our boys were about the same age, so they'd be down at the baseball field, and he'd be sitting along the first baseline in his chair where he always sat, and kids would come by and go, "Hi, Sheriff," you know, they would know him, and he'd smile, so he made a good impression on a lot of the young kids that they felt that they could come up and say hi and smile and say hello to him, so that's a big important thing to start young.
You can't be stuffy in this line of work.
Yeah.
You've got to, we encourage, and I did it often, but you talk about having a designated community policing officer. Mm-hmm. Every one of our officers should be community policing officers. When there isn't calls that they have to do, they should be getting out in the community. You know, you stop at a lemonade stand, you go to a basketball game, you go to a football game, and just interacting with the people. And you learn a lot getting out of your car and getting out of the office. People will pass on concerns that they probably wouldn't pick up the phone to call you about, but when they happen to see you, it's, by the way, Roy, I'd like to talk to you about traffic on this certain road, and then you know we'll do whatever we need to step up patrol in that certain area.
So I'm hearing you say, and see if this is correct. This is tongue in cheek. If we see any of your officers and we have a comment, we should take the initiative and go up and says, Roy said I should tell you about.
You know, Brian, I receive way, way more compliments than I ever do complaints about my officers, and that is refreshing.
So we should encourage people to come up to your officers and talk to them, right?
That's right. Yep. Good. Don't come up behind them. That might hurt the day, but yeah.
They have an awareness and stuff.
Kind of like they say when you approach a helicopter, you know, approach from the front and don't get hit by the tail rotor.
So what are the biggest type of crimes, or what are your biggest concerns as far as crime in our little county?
Right now, I am very concerned about the fentanyl that we're seeing here, and I'm concerned about that. And some of that use leads to property crimes. We have it.
Okay, when you say property crimes, you mean stealing, breaking, and entering, or just vandalism?
Correct. I would say more stealing. Maybe a storage unit, a construction trailer, or whatever venue.
Just when you say things, you're used to what it means.
And so yes. Absolutely.
All right. Good. So all right. So property crimes go up.
Property crimes go up to support some of those habits that we're seeing out
addictions.
There.
Addictions.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So that's your biggest one. So how's the money spent? What's the most expensive crime to take care of? And take us through, let's like fentanyl case. You hear something, you investigate, and just kind of walk through all the steps to where they're arrested.
So let's say we receive a call of a potential drug overdose.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on what evidence there is, the first...
Evidence meaning?
Paraphernalia, for the... that would support that it was an overdose.
Is the ambulance already there?
Most likely, depending on how the person was found, there's probably going to be EMS there. And once that has occurred, you're talking, dollars and cents. There's probably going to be an autopsy that, that would then be a cost to the county.
Okay, so in this scenario, this person has died. The EMS go there. They see the paraphernalia. They will call you then? Or no, it's a death. You have to show up anyway, right?
We do, yes. We do, and just there to rule out, you always want to show your, compassion and be sensitive. Just put yourself in their shoes. But if it does look like there was, some type of criminal activity or, someone may have supplied a substance, then we need to actively investigate that. And that's where the coroner comes in. We work very close. And that's also a constitutional office
that's
here.
That's Betty Nye.
That is.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. You have guys good relationship with her, I imagine.
We do. You have to work very closely. And in fact, we had a recent case where there was an accusation made about how a person may have died. And we were able to rule that out. But... it was necessary to do an autopsy, and which really helped squelch those rumors. But that is a cost to the people here in Vernon County, and I plan to attend the health committee and just tell them. I can't give them every detail, but I want to tell them about that case and just to support Betty's position on why she did. What she did.
This is the county health committee at the Vernon County, one of the board committees.
That's correct.
And Betty's gives a report every time they have a meeting. She gives reports on what the coroner report is. So she goes to that committee all the time. That's why you're going to that committee to support her then.
So, Brian, before the county board consolidated or reduced from 29 board members to 19 board members, a lot of committees were combined. And the law enforcement committee. She was a part of our committee, and now she's under the health committee. So it's a different meeting, a different day, a different time.
Mm-hmm. All right. So go back to this case investigation. You go there. You see there's foul play or something legal. How long does it take you then? Could it take you 2 weeks, 2 months, 6 months to investigate before you can make an arrest? What would you need to make an arrest? What kind of information?
Well, first of all, depending on the scene, depending on the circumstances, everything is a case-by-case basis. We may have to maintain security at that crime scene. Depending on what it is, we may have the crime laboratory from Wisconsin respond to assist us. They don't take it over. We ask them for help, and mm-hmm. they come and assist us, help us process a complicated crime scene. So we may have to keep security on that maybe overnight.
Okay.
That's
meaning an officer has to be there.
Correct. To maintain that security and the integrity of the crime scene, and that doesn't, thankfully, that doesn't happen often here in Vernon County. But once the autopsy occurs, we need to wait for drug testing, and drug testing is not as easy as one would think. You have to know what you're looking for, or give the chemist an idea of what you're looking for. So it takes some time. Mm-hmm. Some of our traffic cases where there's an impaired driver, we can, just recently, it wasn't a good 9 months before we received drug testing results back from the crime laboratory.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Yes.
Nine months before you get the results back. Is that because the lab's just backed up that much?
I believe I don't want to speak for them, but alcohol is pretty easy to test for.
Okay.
And most of those we have back in 2 weeks maximum. But drug testing, those panels take much longer.
Wow. All right. So how many investigators do you have?
We have three investigators right now, and they all have their different area of expertise.
All right. So you investigate it. Then what's your relationship then after you've arrested somebody? Say, we're going to arrest somebody. Whose permission do you have to get? When do you work with the district attorney, and when does it get to court then? What would be the kind of the process for that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important to work with the district attorney before making an arrest. Mm-hmm. That's not always possible and not always practical, but you want to work with your prosecutor because they're the ones that are ultimately going to file the charges or not file charges.
So you have to give them enough information, evidence, for them to file charges. So if he comes back or she comes back and says, we don't have enough evidence, you have to keep working. But at some point you've come to a way that says we have enough evidence to go forward? Would that be accurate?
So some crimes you respond to, you're going to make an immediate arrest. A cut-and-dried situation, just for public safety, you make that arrest.
Speeding tickets, assault and battery, blah, blah, blah.
Yes, you're just going to do that, and then you will send your reports to the district attorney. And then it's up to the DA whether or not to continue with charges and file them with the circuit court. And but if you have a case where it's questionable, maybe your probable cause is questionable, that's where you really want to work with the district attorney. And he or she might say, Roy, we need a little bit more on this before you move forward. So that's where that communication comes in, working together. A lot of our cases, we certainly don't, we don't want to make an arrest every day, or that's we'd be pretty busy, pretty busy with that.
Paperwork.
Paperwork, yeah. A lot of cases, Brian, are investigated and then forwarded to the district attorney for review so the DA can take their time in making a thoughtful charging decision. So if there's no danger to the community, we often will opt not to make an arrest, forward the reports to the prosecutor for review.
So when you make an arrest, there's bail. Who handles that and who sets that and how does that work?
So if we make an arrest for a felony arrest.
Okay. Versus a
misdemeanor.
All right. Yeah. Can you kind of give us?
Yeah. So most arrests are going to be misdemeanor or felony. Misdemeanor cases, with a few exceptions, we can release those folks on their own recognizance and give them a court date, and we do not have to hold a formal hearing.
Speeding ticket.
Yeah, those are they're not most those are non-criminal. They're a civil forfeiture, and so those are given a court date. If they're from out of state, we could require them to post a deposit, but we don't do much of that anymore.
Okay, I'm gonna need to stop for a second here, and then we'll get right back to it. This is Brian Wickert on WDRT with the program Conversations. And today we're speaking with Vernon County Sheriff Roy Torgerson, and we're talking about all the things that the county sheriff does, and we're right in the middle of taking a case after they get from a felony to a misdemeanor. So let's continue with that then.
So let's say we make an arrest for a felony on a Friday mm-hmm. night. We have 48 hours to get them in front of the judge. So if it's a Friday night, you're not going to have enough time. So then what the officer does is completes a probable cause statement, and that's we call the judge after hours and read that probable cause statement to the judge, and then the judge will decide whether there's a probable cause to continue to hold for a formal hearing on perhaps Monday or Tuesday. So we have those 48 hours to get them in front of the court. So Saturday night into Sunday, you're okay. You wouldn't need to do that probable cause statement as long as the DA knows when the arrest was made to mm-hmm. schedule the bail hearing. So let's say that was the case, and let's say an arrest was made on a Sunday afternoon. It was a felony. We hold them right away Monday morning. We schedule a bail hearing with the court to occur within those 48 hours. And it's usually a pretty short proceeding. The district attorney will argue first, give a synopsis of the case. And often the DA has very little in writing from the officer at that time. We complete a summary, but our detailed reports aren't available yet. So it's a very short hearing, just enough to establish probable, mm-hmm. not even, you establish some probable cause and then just decide whether or not there's any flight risk, and the judge ultimately sets that bail. If there's no danger to the community, and often they are released on a signature bond, and in some cases a cash bail is set.
Then they're ready to go. The next step would be eventually they come back to court, but that's out of your area then.
They sign the, well, we keep an eye on those cases, because if someone were to make a mistake and violate their bond, then we'd be looking at a new charge of bail jumping. If they were on bail for a misdemeanor, then that mm-hmm. could become misdemeanor bail jumping. If they're on bail for a felony and they violate their bond, then that would be felony bail jumping. And that'd be a new charge that would have to be filed, just like the first charge.
All right. Good. We're going to run out of our hour here pretty quick, but I want to talk about some of the programs you do, like your hazmat team and your canine team. Tell us a little bit about how the hazmat team came and why we're fortunate to have that in our county.
The first canine handler and canine that I remember was Keith Vance. We called him Trapper, and his dog was Bear. And that was back in the 90s. Uh-huh. And we had one other one other canine. The officer worked part-time for us. But Sheriff Spears really, really got the canine program going after he was elected and took over in 2011. Our canine fund is very solvent. The community is behind our canine, right, and very much so. And currently we have one canine, Dax, mm-hmm, and his handler is Deputy Mark Belisario.
Good.
And we're just so happy and proud of our canine program. We would like to eventually have two to cover different working shifts.
So what do they do as far as what's their duties, the dogs, the canines?
Well, a lot of what they do is public service, giving talks, presentations. Right now we have a younger officer that is looking at becoming a canine handler, and he went to a school to learn how to take bites from the dog, and they put on a sleeve, but the sleeve he has is much, if you were to come over, Brian, and we were to give a canine demo, we would put a sleeve on you, uh-huh, and you could take a bite, and that's a really protective sleeve. The sleeve that the training officer is wearing is much thinner, so the dog can feel more of the muscles, of the arm and the muscle or leg, and so we're working on that. So eventually we'd like to get up to the two canine teams.
Good. And they're mostly used for drug, finding drugs?
A lot of searches. We do get calls of missing children from time to time.
They can do that.
And they can track. They can do article searches. We were out on a tactical call a couple of years ago.
Tactical call means?
SWAT.
Okay.
And there again, we're glad to have that team, and we're glad they're not needed, mm-hmm, that often. But the, I believe it was the Hillsboro canine, Tegan, that, I might be wrong, it's been a few years ago, but mm-hmm, he tracked down an expensive piece of equipment that got lost in the woods, so that was very impressive. And once in a while, you'll have maybe a dementia, Alzheimer's patient that will wander away, yep, and so we use our canines for that as well. And yes, there are some drug cases where we use them too.
And so, what about the hazmat team? Tell us a little bit about that. Who uses that besides Vernon County?
So a big shout out to our emergency management director, Brandon Larson. He runs the hazmat team, and not only for Vernon County, but it's a multi-county team. They go outside the area, such as recently when we had the train derailment south of DeSoto. The Vernon County hazmat team responded to that, and thankfully that was low impact on, mm-hmm, on the environment, yeah, and minor injuries, so that could have been much, much worse, Brian.
It could have been. So what kind of programs and trainings do you do, and since you've taken office, what are some of the things you'd like to see come about?
Brian, I want to see us get back to the basics and taking care of basic needs in the community.
When you say basics, you mean, give me some examples of what you mean by basics.
Basics of getting out into the community, okay, getting to know your community,
okay, good,
communicating, listening to your community, and
building trust and relationships is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. And yes, we need to specialize on certain things, but the end of the day, if we can provide empathy and compassion and actively listen to our community, that's how we find out what their needs really are, and that's who I answer to.
So we hear the term heavy with the badge, and you're smiling and say, you know what it means. So for me, it's somebody that, you know, I'm the officer, I'm important, and they kind of puff their chest out too much. And with this community outreach, you're saying you're not really looking for an officer to be heavy with the badge. Would that be accurate?
We just had a sergeant do a school walkthrough, and he will often play basketball or kickball with the kids, get down on their level. But out in the community, is you can't be that way, Brian. You're not going to be effective if you're badge heavy. And I'm just so glad to work with the people I do. And I receive way more compliments than I ever do complaints.
Now, you said that earlier. What's the to communicate with the department, excuse me, there it goes, the office, what would be the best place for them to, do you have something on your website? Can they just call up, leave a message? How would you prefer to hear from people? If you're saying, I want feedback, is what I'm hearing you say, what would be the best way for people to do that?
The best way would be to call the office and ask for me, and I would be happy to set up a time and talk. If I'm out at a community event, please approach me and let me know what your concerns are, and if it's something you want to have a more in-depth conversation, we can set up a time to talk then.
That's wonderful.
We have a Facebook page that's pretty active, and we read the comments that we receive, and so that's another avenue of feedback. But I would rather have a face-to-face conversation
back
with
to
people.
The basics.
That's right.
Good for you. Good for you. What about your other outreach to the community? Like, people want to go on a ride along, and explain what a ride along is, and then how that would somebody would have to apply to do that.
So typically our ride-alongs have been more for younger folks that are looking to get into a field of law enforcement. I want to change that, and I want to, as a way to be a little more open to the community, I want to offer ride-alongs. You know, of course, they'd have to be scheduled and requested and pass a little bit of a background check before we would, because there's a lot of sensitive information you're going to be around. But I want to expand that. I want to do more ride-alongs.
What if you reached out to like the Ministers Association of Roque here, went to all the ministers of the church and asked them to come with ride-along?
Brian, it's so funny you mentioned that. I'm looking to, I'd like to expand our chaplaincy program. I've already met with our chaplain, and we're going to be meeting on that. Just because we're a very wide county, and part of the chaplain program is the ride-alongs. That's a big part of it. And another program that I've started here is a peer support program for our officers.
Explain that. That sounds interesting.
Well, peer is probably something we've been doing a form of for many years. You might see an officer that maybe they're struggling in their personal life, and you take that time to reach out and just say, hey, Roy, is everything okay? Is there anything you need? And just that little bit of compassion. But I've expanded that where I have trained staff that people can, it's very confidential, and that's the heart of that program is confidentiality. And if someone isn't someone doesn't feel comfortable talking to one of my officers, we're looking at making this more regional where we can go outside the county and work together, and we can help their folks out as well.
So that's mental health for your officers then is what it is?
It is mental health, well-being for our officers, because if they're not taking care of themselves, how can they take care of the rest of us?
That's very true. Yeah. All right, you've got a training room that I've been in down there, and I've heard that it's open to people if it's not being used for training, that public groups like 4-H people can use this group?
That's right. If you contact our office, we have a calendar that we have for the training room. And when the new building was constructed and occupied in 2005, we saw the need for a training and conference room. And so get a hold of me or my staff. And if you have a community group that needs a meeting space, if it's available, we'll make that happen.
I think that's really a wonderful way for people to get to know the sheriff's office, the people over there, just by saying, I want to have a discussion, I want to have an educational evening, no matter what the topic is, and call you up and say, can I use your room? Because it's got the big whiteboards, the screens.
Yes.
And you can probably sit 35 to 50 people in there?
At least. Yeah, 50 would be, that'd be a pretty good crowd in there, but we can make that work.
That is really good. All right, the other thing is, a little bit, we got just a few minutes left here. The mental health problems in our community. Tell us about how that works with your officers and how challenging that is. People that are mentally ill that you have to deal with.
It is really sad to see the amount of mental health issues in the community, and I think we really need to be paying attention to that. I would love someday to see an officer with very specialized training in mental health. You're seeing some of the larger agencies that are obtaining funding to do that, to send out a mental health professional on some of our calls that we go on. It goes back, though, to that empathy and compassion and listening. A lot of potentially serious situations are deflated with just some of those, using some of those basic principles. But it is tough on our officers if we do have to affect a mental health commitment. It can tie up our officers for easily their whole shift.
So this is the biggest hurdle would be budget there, having the money given to you to be able to do this. You've got the ideas. You know what to do. You're limited on your resources, though.
Right now, yes. Yeah. Often we run into an overtime issue. If we have to transport to Winnebago mm-hmm. Mental Health Facility in Oshkosh, that's 3.5 hours one way. And that does not count the time at your local hospital to have them cleared medically yeah. and actually find a suitable receiving facility. So there's a lot of time that goes by, and I don't know that time is well spent because they're not getting help waiting 12 hours to be seen. So that's frustrating.
Our hours come to the end. It flew by, Roy, so I'm so thankful. I feel so fortunate that you're a sheriff and you're looking out after us in the ways, and the challenge you have are quite amazing. So again, thank you very much for coming in, and maybe we should do this again and talk about some other stuff that we could help with the county sheriffs.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian, and I'm looking forward to coming back here very soon.
All right. Thank you very much. Talk to you later. This is Brian Wickert on WDRT with the program Conversations, and we've been speaking with Roy Torgerson today, which is our Vernon County Sheriff. Have a good day.